Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer. Bob, did you know that Neanderthals bury their dead?
Well, the way, Fred, that they bury their dead really puts a nail in the coffin
to
the evolutionist claim. We have been pointing out what creationists have been pointing out for decades, that Neanderthal are people.
They are.
They're human.
Absolutely.
Right. And so we are going to share a number of articles out of the latest issue of Creation Magazine, my favorite creation publication.
Yeah, volume 43, number 3.
Yeah, so that's the summer issue 2021, published out of Australia. They've got offices in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and around the world, but by Creation Ministries International. So, Fred, Neanderthal DNA is like human DNA.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, it's closer to a modern human. You know, if you were to compare like Japanese DNA to Italian DNA, you'd be able to see the difference, right?
Yep.
Well, Neanderthal DNA to modern human DNA, it's closer to our DNA than a chimp DNA is to another chimp within the same species of chimp. So in other words, Neanderthal are people.
Yeah, and we think that Pocahontas, or Senator Warren.
Elizabeth Warren?
Yeah, she's closer to Neanderthal than she is to Native Americans.
Oh, she sure is. In fact, my wife is 1,000 times more Native American, American
really?
Indian, we should say.
Yep.
Because, Fred, I'm a Native American.
Oh, yeah, so am I.
I was born here.
Think about it. Yep.
My kids are Native American. I mean, the left, if they only want to call American Indians Native American, well, then that means my kids have no identity at all.
Yep.
Because they're what? Native nothing. You're Native Canadian, Native Mexican. We here in America, we are Native American.
Yep.
So, but anyway, my kids tell people that their mom is 1,000 times more Native American than Pocahontas. Who's what? 1,000?
Yeah, it's 1,000. Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so we know that Neanderthal are people. But evolutionists, they don't like that. And they like to claim that they're a different species. And so the evidence has been piling up for decades that the creationists have been right all along. So what's the latest thing about them burying their dead?
So, you know, more evidence came in. And the scientist in this article said that burial is the best explanation. So the scientist says, we propose that Neanderthals intentionally dug a pit in which the child was laid.
Yes. And they talk about the orientation of the bodies. In fact, it's not only one. This child you mentioned, Fred, this is a 2-year-old. It's so sad when you read about a 2-year-old dying. Mm-hmm. But of course, kids die. The real tragedy is when it's intentional, like abortion and Planned Parenthood and all that. But this child died 2 years old, and the child's body was oriented in the ground in the same way that all the other Neanderthal skeletons found at this site were oriented, and that is with their head to the east and their body to the west, basically burying them toward the rising sun,
mm-hmm.
with their heads elevated.
Yeah, heads higher than the rest of the body.
Yeah, like a headrest. And so CMI points out that this is just yet more evidence that Neanderthal buried their dead, and this is published in Science Reports, December 2020. So a new scientific discovery, and once again affirming the biblical creationist worldview.
Yeah, and there's more on Neanderthal. So in the PhysOrg, Max Planck Society, they list evidence that Neanderthals and humans used identical technology.
That is so
cool. So much for Neanderthals being more primitive.
Yes, right. The stone tools that we're talking back thousands of years ago, what they called points and cores, until this latest study by, like you said, the Max Planck Society, they said that, well, the tools that we found in this Neanderthal setting, in this Sukba cave in the Middle East, those tools must have been made by more modern type humans. And this study says, no, you can't get away with that. The tools in the Neanderthal setting, they go together. And so, of course, Fred, we know, as we've reported from other journals, that if a Neanderthal was here today in a suit and a tie, you wouldn't even look twice at him on a New York subway, except maybe that he wasn't sleeping and doing drugs.
Yeah.
Maybe that. And he'd be faster and stronger and smarter than we are.
Yep. This next one I thought was really cool. So, and this comes from Nature, Ecology, and Evolution.
That's one of the Nature journals.
Yeah, one of the, yeah.
Right.
And this is from, you know, just a couple months ago. The Neanderthals, they speak just like humans.
They speak? What? How could they find that out, Fred?
Because yeah, I thought
Neanderthals are all dead. But they speak and hear just like modern humans, and they figured this out doing CT scans, and they scanned the Neanderthal. Now, they have modern humans. They know how, like, our inner ear, how it functions,
yep,
and what range of frequency we can hear. And so they scan the Neanderthal skulls. In fact, one of our friends, Dr. Jack Quozzo.
Yeah.
He did x-rays of some of the world's most famous Neanderthal skulls. He wrote a book about it. You and I interviewed him, and at rsr.org/Neanderthal.
Yeah, from a dentist perspective.
Yes. And what a brilliant bit of research he did, and what a fun interview. That was really awesome. Now, Jack has passed away,
mm-hmm,
so he's with the Lord now. But Fred, they figured out that Neanderthals, their hearing abilities, the auditory canal that they had in their inner ear, they could hear up to 5 kilohertz. And according to the scientist who published this article in this Nature journal, this encompasses most of the frequency range of modern human speech sounds. Neanderthals' abilities closely mirrored that of modern humans.
Yeah. Bob, I wonder if these Neanderthals could, you know, hear the beep. You know, when you're a kid, you get a hearing test.
Oh, yeah.
And they put you in headphones and you raise your hand if you can hear a beep.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I was really little, I didn't raise my hand for the really shallow, low beeps.
You didn't?
No. So they told my parents I had hearing loss. Ah. And of course, I used that to my advantage because my dad would go, Fred, do this. And I'd say, what? And my mom would go, Fred, Senior, you know that your son has a hearing loss.
That's selective hearing
loss. It was selective hearing. Well, then as I got more mature, maybe by the time I was 10, I would raise my hand for those beeps. And,
oh,
and so the doctors told my mom, his hearing loss is recovered. That's impossible.
His hearing
and
improved.
And so she thought it was all the praying she was doing, and it was a miracle. And it took me, Bob, I hate to admit this, it took me like 30 years to finally admit to my mom it really wasn't
no,
a miracle.
Oh, no, Fred. So it wasn't a miracle. It was some kid who was disobeying.
And my dad goes, when I admitted it, he's like, I knew it all along.
Oh, so yes, the Neanderthal, they would hear fine, Fred. In fact, they were able to calculate, the researchers, the frequency range of maximum sensitivity. And just like in modern humans, right, it allows us to perceive this wide range of acoustic signals, including consonants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, vowels and consonants,
yeah,
very different in communicating and understanding language.
So not just, ooh, oh,
Exactly. And so for fully developed language, they had the hardware they needed to be able to communicate like we do today. And so they said, hey, this is really a stunning discovery, stunning to them, but expected to the young Earth creationists.
Yeah, the scientists in this review said, the similar hearing and bandwidth of Neanderthal hearing really is the key. This shows that they possessed a communication system that was as complex and efficient as modern human speech.
Wow, that is so great. So CMI, our friends in Australia, they point out that the belief that Neanderthals were somehow more primitive is way out of date.
Oh, yeah.
Way decades out of date. And among other things, they buried their dead. They made jewelry. They manufactured pitch. They built homes outside of caves. They made clothing from animal skins, and they interbred with modern type humans. In fact, people have what? Like 2% Neanderthal DNA is average around the world. They were the post-Babel, the Tower of Babel, post-Babel descendants of Noah, who had the same anatomical design to communicate as any other human.
Yeah, and so another article in Nature.com talks about this interbreeding between Neanderthals and modern humans.
Yes.
So the evidence continues to mount, and this is just from April this year.
Yes, in Creation Magazine. So, yeah, Fred, they have what they say are modern human remains in Europe, but early modern human remains, which they think are like 45,000 years ago. And they say, look, these bones, they've got about 3% Neanderthal DNA because they could still get the DNA, sequence their genomes. And this other bone, this looks like as much as 3.8 Neanderthal DNA. Isn't that funny about Elizabeth Warren? She's more Neanderthal than she is American Indian by 1,000 times or 2,000 times more. That is just bizarre.
Yeah, and so Creation Magazine mentions this paleogeneticist from the University of Tel Aviv, which is interesting.
Yeah, in Israel.
And this guy stated that the research adds to growing evidence that modern humans mixed regularly with Neanderthals.
Yes, absolutely. And Fred,
so this is fully human.
Yeah, and they take these bones from, they say, early modern humans in Europe, and they want them to be over 45,000 years old. That's their story.
Mm-hmm.
But they keep carbon dating them, and they're not getting the dates they want, but they're trying.
Yeah, they are. So the first date they got was 15,000 years ago.
15,000 years, and which was too old, but way too young for their story.
Yeah, and then they got 27,000 years.
They tried harder.
They were
trying harder. Same bones, right?
Yeah.
Same everything, but almost twice as old.
So they're going to try again, and the next time they got 19,000. So that had to really put them into a panic and a tizzy.
Right.
And then finally, they got one at 34,000.
Yeah.
That's still too short, but that guy probably got additional funding.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Because he was closer.
Keep working at it. Keep digging that skull. Yeah. Eventually, you're going to give us a date that we like. And we laugh about this, but that's what they do. Like Skull 1470, that whole hysterical account that was published in the journal Nature, where they just constantly were redating the same skull with dramatically different dates because they needed it to fit their evolutionary story. And Fred, you remember what they eventually did? They have this skull that's very human-like, and the first dates said it was like millions of years old, and it freaked them out.
Oh, yeah.
And so they finally threw out all of their potassium-argon dating, their strontium-rubidium dating. They said, forget of all that. We figured out how to date this skull.
And it was the pigs, wasn't it?
It was in a layer with some pigs. And they said, so we know when the pigs evolved, so that's how they dated the skull.
Yeah.
So they dated
it.
Not based on their radiometric dating precision, but on their story.
Yeah.
They dated the story based on their story.
Yeah, Bob, that reminds me of Marvin Lubinow's book. It was one of the great creation books called
Bones of Contention.
Exactly. At the end of that book, he's got a chapter on this whole skullduggery with 1470, and that's where he made the statement how the pigs won out
eventually.
It went over the course of at least a decade.
There was a science conference over in Europe, and literally some of the scientists were coming in with hats and ties with pigs on them.
Yeah.
So it's the pigs versus the radiometric dating, and the pigs won.
Yep.
So when you hear a naive evolutionist tell you that their dating of these fossils is precision dating, radiometric dating, it is a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And you could listen to one of our interviews with a scientist. He got his PhD in nuclear engineering, and that's at rsr.org/radiometric dating. What a fun interview that was.
Yeah. Well, next, you know, and this is, again, going back to people who supposedly lived in the Stone Age.
Yes.
These guys were extracting salt from seawater.
Who?
Which is, you know, pretty technical thing to do.
Who was?
Was it the British?
Well, it was Stone Age Brits. This is published in New Scientist. Now, that's Europe's number one science magazine. It's not a peer-reviewed journal, as I recall. It's sort of like our Scientific American, a step up from Discover magazine.
Yeah.
So New Scientist, and they say they were extracting salt from seawater when? How long ago?
Well, it's not around the time of King Arthur, right?
No.
I mean, it's Brits way before back that. 5,500 years ago.
Before Jesus. They say it was 5,500 years ago, and that freaks out the evolutionist, Fred, because this expert is quoted as saying that you would expect that perhaps they could do this in the Iron Age, like 2,500, 3,000 years ago, maybe. This is almost twice as old as that. And so it turns out that there were salt-making kilns in northeast England near the town of Loftus. And in those kilns, they found a hazelnut shell. I really like that because that's something, that's a specimen that's worth radiocarbon dating. You know, quite often, Fred, they'll do things like they'll take an Egyptian pharaoh's tomb and maybe there will be a dagger with a wooden handle and they'll date the wooden handle. But it's interesting that that wood could have come from a tree that was cut down 100 years previously or 200 years previously. But a hazelnut there in the kiln, you got to think that wasn't hanging around for 300 years.
Yeah, exactly.
That's got to be the guy's lunch.
Yep.
Right? So they date it and they say, and carbon 14 dating, it's not flawless. And the problems it has, we've discussed in a way that people could really understand what they're looking at when they see these dates.
Now, Walt Brown has a great section on that in his book.
In his book, in the beginning, we cover it at rsr.org/14C.
Okay.
For carbon 14. But this story could go on our genius page.
Genius of Ancient Man
the
list.
Genius of Ancient Man.
We get to keep adding to our lists every show, it seems like. We've got more items for whatever list we have.
Because, Fred, here's what one of the researchers said. This discovery surprised many because it means that people in Great Britain were producing salt thousands of years earlier than thought, and they were using industrial-style processes. They were producing salt from seawater using industrial-style processes. That is so funny.
It is. So they had potato chip packaging that said, you know, made with real sea salt.
Yes. Next story in the current issue of Creation Magazine has to do with the Mars rover, Perseverance, and it had a landing parachute, and NASA put a message on the parachute. And here's a photograph in Creation Magazine of the parachute. Nothing especially amazing, but it uses the slogan they have at their jet propulsion laboratory. It says, dare mighty things.
Yeah, so it's kind of encoded in a way that it's, you know, it's not written out clearly, but you can make it out. Anybody could look at it and figure out what it says.
So the creationists down in Australia, they remind us about SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yeah, looking for any kind of code from
coming
outer space.
From outer space.
Yeah, to show there's intelligent life.
Yeah.
So here's this guy, whoever put this on there, his attempt to show that, hey, there's intelligent life.
To show the aliens. Isn't that funny, Fred? Like the Mars rover wouldn't tell them that there's intelligence and that the parachute itself.
Yeah.
The parachute itself wouldn't tell them, but they have to read dare mighty things. Okay, fine. But if we got the shortest code coming in from outer space on one of our radio telescopes, the folks at SETI would blow a gasket. They would go nuts. They'd say, look, we have proof of intelligence. And yet, as our creationist friends say at Creation Magazine, they say, meanwhile, the encyclopedic information encoded on the DNA of all living things is ignored.
Exactly. That's so overwhelming evidence.
In their search for intelligence, right?
And they can't find a single code. It did help them discover pulsars, though.
Yeah.
They thought that was a code.
Yes.
Then they realized that, you know, eventually that led them to discover pulsars.
Yeah, that's neat. So, Fred, SETI, they sabotaged themselves by rejecting the most significant and abundant data they could ever have to search for extraterrestrial intelligence that is the intelligence of the Creator, who did not originate from Earth, extraterrestrial. He's our eternal God.
So now let's come back from outer space to our planet.
Okay.
And let's go to Greenland. What's up with Greenland?
Oh, yeah. So they have a lot of ice in Greenland. Used to be greener, mm-hmm. you know. And, Fred, they have this ice core. It goes through about a kilometer of ice. And at the bottom, they have 4.5 meters of dirt. So that's about 15 feet of dirt in the core, if you could picture that. You got a drill. And in the center of the drill, that's where it's capturing, undisturbed mostly, all the ice. And then you get down the dirt. And Fred, what they found in the dirt is so cool. Now, this is coming from PNAS. PNAS, P-N-A-S, mm-hmm. the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And it's this year, 2021. They've got about 15 feet of dirt in this ice core, and what they find in it are twigs, apparently from fir trees, spruce trees, and they found leaves where they can infer that the temperatures were warmer back before the flood. This particular core had been lost for decades until they found it in a freezer in 2017, and Fred, the scientists were absolutely stunned.
Wow. So they left this thing in a freezer
yeah.
for all these years.
Yeah. And this is beautiful because creationist scientific discovery fuels creationism. We love it. They're forever being shocked.
Yeah.
Because what another, they find.
Yeah. It could go on our list of shocked evolutionists.
Yeah. Right.
They're always shocked about something.
Yeah. Because the lead researcher, again, this is in PNAS, said ice sheets typically pulverize and destroy everything in their path. But what we discovered was delicate plant structures, perfectly preserved. They're fossils, but they look like they died yesterday. This is constant, right?
Exactly.
Here at Real Science Radio, we just celebrate all these wonderful discoveries.
I'd like to be the person who found this in the freezer, you know? He was probably next to that 5-year-old burrito,
yeah.
and he finds this
yeah.
this ice core although, stuff from beneath this ice sheet.
Although these things would be like 4 inches in diameter and thousands of feet long.
Yeah.
So maybe next to the frozen Taco Bell restaurant.
There you go.
A big, big freezer, right? So once again, Fred, and this happens all over the world and all the time, the discoveries are those that are celebrated by young Earth creationists mm-hmm. and that contradict the expectations of the old Earth secular evolutionists.
Yep. Lots of shocked evolutionists working for Walt Brown.
Yeah. And you could find that list we did at rsr.org/shocked.
Shocked.
Our list of shocked evolutionists. That was really fun. Remember, Fred, they were jaw-dropping and
yeah.
they were just
yep.
so stunned. Because their discoveries contradict their most basic assumptions. Not because they just discovered something new. That doesn't shock them. That's just cool.
Or like the one where they found that the Y chromosome of chimps was like 30% different than humans.
Yes.
And that's supposed to be very robust or very well conserved where it shouldn't change
yeah,
over time.
Yeah, the Y chromosome,
right. It'd be the perfect one to look at to see if we're really related to chimps. And it was 30% different. And so the scientists said it was horrendous.
Horrendous.
Is horrendous a scientific term?
No,
or
I don't,
an emotional term?
I don't think so, right, because they were horrified.
Yep.
Because it should have been 98.8% the same. 30% they couldn't even line up. So the whole human to chimp DNA comparison is a boon for young Earth creationists, and it's becoming a nightmare for the evolutionary story, unless you want to believe the people who are the marketers, the snake oil salesmen, the high priest of Darwinism, like Dawkins and Bill Nye, the science guy.
Yep. So, Bob, I actually wanted to get to a news story if we have time, and this is the one that just recently, this week, about
yes.
this 3D genome structure in the DNA that influences cancer. So it's from two papers published in leading journals, one Science Advances and the other Genome Biology.
Yes. And Fred, to describe this discovery and how it could help diagnose and treat cancer. Now, they were looking at two particular kinds of cancer. It's so sad even to think about it. But one is pediatric brain tumors. Mm. So sad. The other is bladder cancer. So they're looking at patients who have those two kinds of cancers, and they looked at something different, not just mutations in the DNA. That's typically what they would look for. And so to design, sort of like designer genes, targeted immunotherapy, so it's not radiation and chemotherapy. That's like using a shotgun when what you really want to do is have a precision scalpel.
Yeah.
Go in and figure out what's wrong. So targeted antibodies, immunotherapy. Well, Fred, normally they look at the mutations in your DNA. Now what they're doing is looking at the 3D structure of your chromosomes. This is incredible.
Oh, absolutely.
This sounds like science fiction. This is such brilliant science, it boggles the minds of the geneticists who are making these discoveries. But it turns out that when your DNA folds up, there's 3 billion genetic letters in human DNA. And if you lay them out, just unfurl the DNA molecule, it's like 6 feet long. So imagine you got to take that, smush it all together, and put it in a cell that you can't even see. It's so tiny.
Mm-hmm.
But not in the whole cell, just in the very center of the cell, the nucleus of the cell. You got to put all that DNA in there. And as you're folding it up, make sure it's in 46 chromosomes.
Yep.
And those chromosomes have millions to hundreds of millions of DNA letters in them. So, Fred, when they were first discovering this, they thought, well, this is crazy. These genes that have to do with, let's say, your retinas or metabolism, there are some genes that are here on your DNA, and there are other related genes that are so far away, they're like halfway through the whole strand. They're like 20 million DNA letters down the spiral staircase. They're way far away.
Yeah.
They said it doesn't make sense. You'd think that the related genes would be together.
Mm-hmm.
So what they learned next blew their minds. And that's that when the DNA gets wound up into chromosomes, those genes that are far away, if you stretched it all out, well, it turns out your DNA is never stretched out like that. When you wind them up into the chromosomes, those genes end up right next to each other. And in the chromosome, on the outer edge of the chromosome, in these tiny loops that if you look at a chromosome through tremendous magnification, sometimes it looks fuzzy. And there's all these little tiny loops of DNA, and those loops are coming together and bringing genes that are far away normally, but now in that particular kind of cell, for those genes, they're needed at the same time. They're right next to each other.
Yeah, and Dr. Kevin Anderson in an email to us on this said that it's sometimes called chromosome kissing. And this is so interesting. So portions of a gene or a series of genes are found on different chromosomes or different areas of the same chromosome and are only expressed when the different segments make contact.
Wow.
That is so amazing.
And Dr. Anderson, he's a molecular biologist, a friend of Real Science Radio. He continued in the email, Fred, to you and I, this is why when researchers first looked at the human genome sequence, they thought there were lots of broken genes or an odd scattering of genes.
Yeah, remember that? I mean, we've heard evolutionists say that for years.
Yeah,
you
Eugenie
know?
Scott on the show
back your TV
in
show
the
1990s. Back in,
Yeah, we have that junk DNA.
Yep.
Famous anti-creationist, PhD scientist.
Pseudogenes, you know, these broken genes.
Yeah, junk DNA. In fact, if you go to rsr.org/junk, you could hear Eugenie Scott saying that all this stuff is junk DNA and it's proof that there's no creator.
Yep.
Ha, what a joke that was.
Yep.
Because now with the ENCODE project published by the journal Nature, they see that the vast majority of the human DNA is not junk. It's functional. And Fred, that's devastating to the Darwinists.
Oh, hugely devastating.
Yeah. They admit that it's devastating if it's true. And since the ENCODE project was published, far more data has come out that the DNA is astoundingly sophisticated and functional.
And that you are without excuse to believe that that all happened by chance and mutation.
So Kevin writes to us, slowly they began to understand this distribution makes sense when you look at how the chromosomes physically interact when they're wound up in a three-dimensional way. It's stunning, Fred. It's like if we were to take a string that was a mile long, and every 750 feet, we used a black marker and we marked part of the string black. Then we went another 800 feet, marked another part. Then another 1,000 feet, marked another part. Then 48 feet, marked another part. And then we said to people, okay, scrunch it all up. Roll it up into a twine ball.
Mm-hmm.
And they rolled it all up. And lo and behold, every part we marked, they were all on the surface of the twine ball, and they were all right next to each other. What are the chances of that, right?
Yeah.
But it turns out that DNA, not only of human DNA, but a million species, they do this in the most extraordinary ways.
It's kind of like three hard drives kind of rubbing against each other, and your word program somehow behaves differently, has new functionality when it rubs with the other hard drive.
Yeah, right.
I mean, how could you even design something like this?
Yes.
God can design it.
Yes.
Trust me, us engineers, we can't design something like that.
And you're a very successful professional engineer, Fred.
Well,
just
thanks.
In case we have new listeners who don't know that. So let's end with Kevin Anderson's statement that he says, not only is the designer's brilliance on full display with how God designed our DNA, but it is not even rational to attempt to attribute that functionality to mutation and natural selection that is being cobbled together by trial and error. It is absurd to highest degree.
Yep.
And it is. And Kevin is right.
He is right, once again.
And Genesis is right. And the Bible's right.
Once again.
And, you know, when the Bible's right, that means that Jesus Christ rose from the dead.
And is who he says he is.
Yes. And
might be important to listen to what he has to say.
The Apostle Paul wrote that if Jesus did not rise from the dead, then Christianity is false.
Yep.
And that takes courage to say that, right? But it's the kind of courage that comes with knowing the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But then he didn't write this. But we realize a corollary of that, if Jesus did rise from the dead, that means that Christianity is true and every other religion is false.
Every single other one.
Because he said, no man comes to the Father but by me.
Yep.
And that's why, Fred, you and I share the discoveries of scientists that they affirm God's word so that someone listening to this program could humble themselves. In humility, it could be tough. But ask God for the courage to be humble and say, God, I know that I am not God, and I know that you are real, and you made me.
Yeah.
And I'm so sorry that I've hurt others, and I've hurt myself, and I'm sure I've hurt you too.
Yeah.
That's called sin.
And it's wonderful how it edifies and strengthens the faith of Christians who aren't hearing this, and they're hearing this for the first time.
Yeah.
It gives them a stronger faith, right?
Yeah.
Faith is the evidence of things not seen.
Yes. Right out of the book of Hebrews.
Yep.
Faith is the evidence of things not seen. And so please, if you don't know Jesus Christ as your Savior, please pray and ask him to forgive you of your sins and trust in his death and his resurrection, and you will be saved.
You will be for eternity.
Yes.
That's pretty important.
So awesome. So thank you, Fred.
Thanks, Bob.
So for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio, this is Bob Enyart. May God bless you.